Now, as predicted in the U.S. National Intelligence Council's report, the relentless shift of world economic strength from west to east, from Europe to Asia, from America to China, might lead to a decline in U.S. global power. Alternatively, a technological Hail Mary's pass in the form of new robotic information regime just might allow Washington sufficient geopolitical power in excess of its waning economic strength to extend the American century to 2050 or maybe even beyond.
That's Alfred McCoy, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Alfred McCoy on the decline of U.S. global power. What's the shelf life of empires? Decades? Maybe centuries? All things come to an end. Recall Shelley's great poem, Ozymandias, about the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses the Great and his seemingly invincible kingdom. Ozymandias was Greek for Ramses. Here's a part of that poem. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, and on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. It's difficult to discuss imperialism because there is virtually uniform elite opinion that the United States is not an empire. Washington will not willingly concede its global superpower position. But remember the omnipotent British Empire? Where is it today? Our guest is Alfred McCoy, an award-winning professor of history at the University of Wisconsin. He's the author of the classic The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. He's also the author of Policing America's Empire and Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. He spoke at the University of Montana in Missoula.
In January of 2010, President Obama delivered a State of the Union address that warned Congress and the country of serious challenges to America's global power. Our president said, quote, China is not waiting to revamp its economy. Germany is not waiting. India is not waiting. These nations aren't playing for second place. Then, in a rhetorical flourish that brought forth very rare and thunderous bipartisan applause from Congress, Obama announced, well, I do not accept second place for the United States of America. Echoing those words dutifully a few days later, Vice President Joseph Biden rejected the possibility of U.S. decline as a global power, saying, we will continue to be the most significant and dominant influence in the world as long as our economy is strong. But in December 2012, about 2 years after those fulsome endorsements of the persistence of U.S. power, the U.S. National Intelligence Council, our nation's supreme intelligence analytic body, offered a far more sober prediction. And in its report on the future of U.S. global power, our Supreme Intelligence Analysis Unit said the following. By 2030, Asia will have surpassed North America and Europe combined in terms of global power, largely reversing the historic rise of the West since 1750. The United Kingdom, from 1820 to 1870, the 50 years preceding its rise to global power, raised its share of world gross product, the total output of the globe, by less than 1%. During the 50 years preceding the U.S. rise to global power, we raised our share of world gross output by more than 2%. And then in China, the 2 decades preceding what the National Intelligence Council estimates will be China's rise to preeminent world power, not 1%, not 2%, but an increase in China's share of gross world output of 5%, an extraordinarily rapid increase. With the future of U.S. global power now being debated at the highest levels in Washington, D.C., it seems timely for us here tonight to ask a few questions. First, what kind of empire is this American imperium? That is, how does it manage its administration, pacification, and most importantly for our discussion tonight, its information? Next, how have pacification campaigns at the periphery of American power migrated homeward here to the homeland, to the metropole? And finally, and perhaps most importantly, will U.S. global hegemony, will U.S. global dominion continue deep into the 21st century? In the past century, as three U.S. pacification campaigns in Asia have approached defeat, if not disaster, the U.S. military has mobilized every possible technological resource to amass a vast array of information for pacification, forging thereby powerful new systems for data management, which soon migrated back to the American metropole. Consequently, during the past century, the information infrastructure for U.S. global power has advanced through three distinct technological phases or regimes. First, the manual information collection regime during the Philippine-American War from 1898 to 1907. Next, a computerized data management during the Vietnam War from 1963 to 75. And most recently, the robotic systems integration arising from our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq from 2001 to 2014. Reviewing the succession of these information regimes leads to some ambiguous initial insights about the future of U.S. global power. Now, on the one hand, this information infrastructure seems to have a kind of inbuilt engineering with a unique capacity for self-correction that makes every defeat, every reverse, no matter how searing in the historical moment, an experiment that later leads to important innovation. But on the other hand, this distinctive information infrastructure's preference for what we might call superficial data over deep cultural knowledge about foreign societies creates, as we'll see in the discussion that follows, closed, self-referential information loops that can foster illusions with a potential for future military disaster akin to our past debacles in Vietnam or Afghanistan. Let's now explore this history of these three information regimes and their role in the rise of U.S. global power. Let's begin with stage one, the manual information regime in the Philippines. I described this in an earlier book that I wrote called Policing America's Empire. The U.S. system of imperial knowledge traces its origins to a synergy of innovations in the management of textual, statistical, and visual data that during the 1870s and the 1880s created a capacity for the surveillance of the many rather than just a few. Let's listen as the dates sing. But let's listen as the dates sing a cappella, a song of progress. The synergy of Thomas Alva Edison's quadruplex telegraph, 1874, Philo Remington's commercial typewriter, the same year, 1874, and Alexander Graham Bell's telephone, 1876, allowed the transmission of textual data in unprecedented quantities at the unequaled speed of 40 words per minute with unsurpassed accuracy. America may have lagged behind in biometrics, leaving the systemization to the French and fingerprinting to the British, but by 1900, this country was a world leader in police fire communications with a total nationwide of 764 municipal fire alarm systems and 148 police patrol systems handling 41 million messages every year. Statistical innovation came at the opposite ends of the same state in the mid-1870s as Melville Dewey, as in Dewey Decimal System, began cataloging the Amherst College Library and Charles A. Cutter engaged in similar work at Boston's Athenaeum Library. The two of them invented the smart number that reduced otherwise unmanageable mountains of data to alphanumeric codes for rapid filing, retrieval, and cross-referencing. When you check a book out of the library, look on the spine and realize you're looking at a revolution in information technology, because that number doesn't simply describe the order of the book. That simple code on the spine describes the content of the work and distinguishes it from all the other millions of books that might be in any library. After the engineer Herman Hollerith patented the punch card in 1889, the U.S. Census Bureau adopted his electrical tabulating machine in 1890 to accomplish then what was regarded as a modern miracle by enumerating over 62 million Americans within just weeks. This was a stunning success that later led engineer Hollerith to become one of the founders of the International Business Machines Corporation, better known as IBM. But on the eve of empire in 1898, Congress, courts, and civil society still barred any federal application of all of these innovations to internal security, leaving ample room for modernization of America's weak patchwork state that came with stunning speed in the subsequent decade of imperial expansion. Now, in retrospect, we might ask, were these American empire builders, like their European counterparts, Orientalists? That is to say, scholars who used deep cultural knowledge of language and texts and monuments and ruins to amass cultural knowledge for colonial rule? Or was there a different, a distinctly American style of empire, an American style of imperial information? With their schoolboy lessons in Latin and Greek, British colonials emerged from Oxford and Cambridge with a classical approach to empire, heading east beyond Suez to probe textual and archaeological remains for a timeless cultural essence that allowed them to manipulate their colonies from within. By contrast, with their vocational training, American imperialists adopted their new information technology for colonial rule, heading west across the Pacific to survey the Philippine present through the superficialities of census, mapping, meteorology, photography, taxonomy, and police surveillance. To gain a sense of this distinctive U.S. approach to imperial information, I went to three dominant colonial journals published by the British, the French, and the Americans in Southeast Asia. And I enumerated all 604 articles published in these three journals from 1906 to 1916. In their journal, Philippine Science, Americans explored their colony social and national environment through empirical research with pragmatic applications for their colonial administration. Better schools, better road, better fishing. While the French writing under China in the Bulle de l'École Française de Saint-Marion was skewed toward classical Orientalist studies, they focus on art, archaeology, history, and language, philology. The British research on Malaya, published in the Journal of the Malay Branch of the Royal Asiatic Society, lay somewhere in between. Now, if the prime aim of the modern state is, as James Scott has argued so persuasively, I think, to establish the metrics for rendering a social hieroglyph into a legible and administratively more convenient format, then U.S. colonial rule was unrivaled in its ability to read alien terrains through such surface reconnaissance, through such practical information. To pacify a protracted Philippine resistance that continued for a decade after the U.S. landing in 1898, the U.S. regime elaborated its information technologies and its approach to information into a three-tier security apparatus: the U.S. Army's Division of Military Information, the Manila Police, and the Philippines Constabulary. Let's look at each one of these colonial police forces, colonial agencies in turn. Let's begin with the U.S. Army's Division of Military Information. In December of 1900, the U.S. Army established the Division of Military Information in the Philippines, creating the first field intelligence unit in the 100-year history of the U.S. Army. After assuming command of this fledgling unit in early 1901, Captain Ralph Van Diemen, a man later known as the father of U.S. military intelligence, collected comprehensive data on the Filipino elite in every municipality. Here's it. That's General Ralph Van Diemen, the father of U.S. military intelligence, as he was photographed as chief of counterintelligence. Whoops, thank you. Chief of counterintelligence at the Versailles Peace Conference in Paris in 1919. Now, as head of U.S. military intelligence in the Philippines, Captain Van Diemen had all of the army posts, all 460 of them in the country, collect every bit of data on every politically active Filipino. In other words, to map the political activities of the entire Filipino nation. And to do this, they compiled cards. And here's a card, all right? One of these cards. And it's amazingly detailed. It gives us the name, his residence, his height, weight, age. And note the extraordinary precision. Not 5'6", but 5'6½". And not simply, middle class or rich, $20,000 Mexican. So incredibly detailed information were amassed on these cards. Let's look at our second unit, the Manila Police. During its three-year pacification of Manila from 1898 to 1901, the U.S. Army created a Metropolitan Police Force for Manila that applied military intelligence and data management to domestic counterintelligence. Within 20 years, Manila's detectives would amass photographic files for 70% of the city's total population of 200,000 people. Finally, let's turn to the Philippines Constabulary. Only weeks after taking office in July 1901, the first U.S. civil governor of the Philippines, the future U.S. president, William Howard Taft, established the Philippines Constabulary as a colonial omniscient agency to monitor both private lives and public discourse. Through pervasive surveillance by some 200 Filipino spies working for the Constabulary's Information Division, the Philippine Constabulary probed private social space for incriminating information on both Filipino politicians and American colonials. Now, since Americans philandered, Filipinos gambled, and just about everybody who was anybody embezzled, all political actors faced the constant threat of political death by scandal. Within this police panopticon, the constabulary was systematic in its information control, releasing scurrilous information to destroy an enemy and suppressing scandal to protect an ally. Let's examine an example of data release. By late 1904, Bishop Gregorio Aglipay was about to legitimate his nationalist schism, his separation from the Catholic Church, and his formation of a nationalist Philippine independent church with a final critical step, the grant of apostolic succession from the U.S. Episcopal Church that would infuse him with the sacral power to turn ordinary bread and wine into the body and blood of Jesus Christ. Now, Bishop Aglipay, understanding that when he founded his church, they needed to have this sacral power, but the only way it can be granted is to be touched by a bishop who was touched by a bishop who was touched by a bishop who was touched by a bishop going back 2,000 years to Peter, the first bishop of Rome. And unless you have that unbroken apostolic succession, you as a bishop don't have that power to transform bread and wine into the body and blood of Jesus Christ. So what did Aglipay do when he established his church? He had a dozen of his priests stand over him. He knelt in the streets of Manila, and they touched him, and they infused him with the power, except they all knew that they couldn't give it, that he didn't have it, that they were all illegitimate, that he had to be touched by somebody who'd been touched in order to have it. So where could he get it? Not from any Catholic parish anywhere in the world, but from the U.S. Episcopal Church, which, as a schematic nationalist church, had that apostolic succession. But instead of that happening, the chief of constabulary, a U.S. Army officer named Henry Allen, blocked legitimation of the schism by putting a postage stamp on an envelope and mailing the Episcopal bishops, who were then assembling in Boston for their national conference, and sending them an intelligence profile stating falsely that during the Philippine Revolution, Aglipay had ordered a Spanish bishop flogged with 300 lashes. Now, I'm sorry to wake you up. I know I have a wonderfully mellifluous voice. I've been able to put my children to sleep for years now. But let's just wake up and ask ourselves, what's wrong with an allegation that somebody has been flogged with 300 lashes? What's wrong with that? What would happen to any human being who has the shirt shipped from his or her back and is flogged 300 times? You're dead, right, and that bishop wasn't dead, okay? So it was a transparent lie. But in fact, the Philippine Constabulary had discovered not only the uses of information, but the uses of disinformation. By penetrating this sanctum of sacral mystery, the Constabulary had, for the price of a postage stamp, delivered a near-fatal blow to this new Philippine church. Let's turn now to an example of data suppression. Among the countless thousands of intelligence reports that crossed his desk, Constabulary Chief Henry Allen carried just one dossier from Manila to command of the German Rhineland after World War I and into retirement near Washington, D.C., where he was briefly considered for vice presidential nomination of the United States. And this report was titled The Family History of MQ. Amidst its many sordid tales of murder and incestuous relationships, this report alleged that a rising Filipino politician, MQ, Manuel Quezon, had concealed a premarital liaison with his half-sister and his future first lady by arranging an abortion. Now, since Quezon served the constabulary faithfully as a spy, this document remained safely buried in General Allen's private papers until his death, thereby assuring that Manuel Quezon could ascend to becoming the first Philippine president in 1935, and after independence in 1946, the namesake for his nation's new capital city, Quezon City. The creation of this powerful colonial police would prove mutually transformative, making the constabulary an arm of Philippine presidential power throughout the 20th century, and leaving a lasting institutional imprint on the emerging American state. Drawing upon security methods developed in the colonial Philippines, Colonel Ralph Van Diemen, promoted from captain to colonel, founded the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Division at the start of World War I in 1917. As it happened, at the start of that war, the U.S. Army was the only army on either side of the battle lines in Europe that didn't have an intelligence service. So Colonel Ralph Van Diemen established the Military Intelligence Division and recruited a staff that quickly grew from one himself to 1,700, and in collaboration with the FBI, he deployed 350,000 citizen intelligence operatives to amass over a million pages of surveillance reports, largely on German Americans, laying the foundation for domestic surveillance apparatus. This first manual information reached its apotheosis during World War II, when Washington gave the FBI expanded powers for domestic surveillance and established the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, as the nation's first worldwide espionage agency. Now, among the nine branches of the OSS, the forerunner of the CIA, the Research and Analysis Branch recruited a staff of nearly 2,000 academics who amassed over 300,000 photographs, a million maps, and 3 million file cards, which they deployed via an indexing and cross-indexing and counter-indexing system to produce 3,000 staff studies and answers to countless tactical questions. Yet by early 1944, the OSS found itself, in the words of historian Robin Winks, quote, drowning under the flow of information, with many of the materials it had collected so carefully stacking up in storage unread and unprocessed. Although the OSS left a lasting institutional legacy for its successor, the CIA, this manual information, absent some technological change, might have eventually collapsed under its own weight, imposing some limits on America's voracious appetite for information. Turning now to domestic security during World War II, on the eve of that war in 1940, General Ralph Van Diemen, though long retired, came out of retirement and represented the military at the Army FBI Delimitation Conference. Like the Pope at Tordesillas in 1493, this conference divided the world, giving the FBI control of all U.S. counterintelligence for the Americas, North and South, and requiring wiretapping that the President, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, soon approved. Now, what made FBI director with this power so amazingly powerful was the telephone. With 20% of the country and the entire political elite by now owning phones, the FBI could wiretap local switchboards to monitor both suspected subversives and the president's domestic enemies, such as the leader of the isolationist movement, Charles Lindbergh. After a quarter century of wiretaps, by the late 1960s, Hoover had built a veritable archive of the sexual preferences among America's powerful and used it to shape the direction of U.S. politics, distributing a dossier on Adlai Stevenson's alleged homosexuality to assure his defeat in the 1952 presidential elections, circulating audio tapes of Martin Luther King's philandering, and monitoring President Kennedy's affair with a mafia mistress. After the U.S. Senate discovered that these FBI excesses included the blatantly illegal counterintelligence or COINTEL program, to break the anti-war and civil rights movements with agent provocateur tactics. In 1978, Congress created the FISA courts to issue warrants for all future national security wiretaps. Let's move on to stage two now in our succession of U.S. information regimes and shift to the computerized information regime in Vietnam. Under the pressures of a protracted war in Indochina from 1964 to 1974, the U.S. information infrastructure made rapid strides in computerized data management, whose sum was nothing less than a second American information regime. Let's look at a few of these efforts at computerized pacification in Vietnam. First and fundamentally, the CIA's Phoenix program tried to create a potent synergy of computerized data collection and localized coercion that would, in theory, sweep the Viet Cong communist guerrillas from the villages of South Vietnam and do so by conducting 41,000 extrajudicial killings. So from the Phoenix Center, in every province in the country, information flows in from rural development cadres, combat units, provincial reconnaissance units information. Then this is turned over to provincial reconnaissance units, which were mercenaries in the employ of the CIA. They went out, they conducted assassinations or brought people back in for torture, where they generated more information into the Phoenix Center, and so it went. The result was, although this information led to tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of instances of torture and 41,000 extrajudicial executions, not a single top-ranking Viet Cong was ever captured during the history of the Phoenix program. This raises the possibility that communist counterintelligence had fed this killing machine with American supporters or neutralists. But whatever the reason might have been, it simply didn't work. In a parallel effort, the U.S. command structure conducted a monthly survey called the Hamlet Evaluation System, or HES, requiring that U.S. military advisors serving in the provinces of Vietnam rate the loyalties for all of South Vietnam's 12,000 villages on an IBM dot matrix map with an illusory precision. After Defense Secretary Robert McNamara told the CIA in late 1966 to, quote, design me something that will tell us the status of control in the countryside, CIA intelligence specialists identified 18 variables that allowed U.S. military advisors to assess the security in 12,000 South Vietnamese hamlets, every hamlet in this entire country, on a 5-point scale from A, meaning secure or pro-American, all the way to E, meaning Viet Cong or communist control. Every month, the U.S. command's powerful IBM computers translated these reports into a consolidated HES security report arrayed on a dot matrix computer map, which soon became an illusory, deceptive visual icon that seemed to indicate that we were winning the war, that our control over the countryside was working. Let's look at some examples of this. Okay, we look at Dinh Tung province. Here we see, in February of 1967, the dark of communist control, with just 15% of villages showing the white, the light, of secure A rating, secure pro-American rating, a dismal, dreary situation, okay? The second map reveals improved security by July of 1969. After the U.S. Army's Operation Petey Express killed 11,000 civilians in the area during the previous 6 months, pushing back the dark of the contested villages rated darkly D and E. And then, here's the third map. Ah, look at that, the light of victory. June 1971 heralds the dawn of victory with 96% of all villages graded A, secure, or B, largely secure, or C, balance of forces mean it's even Steven with the commies. We've won the Vietnam War right there, okay? It's over, 96% secure. And that's a tough Viet Cong province. Now, as the U.S. pacification czar and career CIA operative Roger Comer later explained, the Hamlet Evaluation Survey was unable to measure the all-important qualitative variable of popular commitment of peasants to either the Viet Cong or our allies, the Saigon government. So instead of that awkward, unquantifiable variable, the Hamlet Evaluation Survey used quantitative methods that Comer called very gross and oversimplified because we were trying desperately to find countrywide indicators And naturally, the only indicators we could use were those that were statistically comparable and measurable. If we are to believe Comer, U.S. officials needing data on the critical but unquantifiable question of popular loyalty simply measured a few unrelated variables that happened to be quantifiable and then based their policies on those numbers. In other words, we just made them up. Even though we were fully aware all the time that the numbers were imperfect, incomplete, and illusory. Consequently, the South Vietnamese population rated secure climbed relentlessly to 75% of those pacified on the eve of the disastrous 1968 Tet Offensive. 6 years later, as the Saigon regime was plunging towards collapse and was losing popular support, the HES survey found that South Vietnam was 84% pacified. In the end, these automated indices led South Vietnam's government, said CIA Director William Colby, quote, to delude itself about its standing with its own people.
You're listening to Alfred McCoy, The Decline of U.S. Global Power. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In a third effort at computerized intelligence, the Combined Documents Exploitation Center near Saigon encoded over 3 million pages of enemy documents captured every year on movie film, 35-millimeter movie film, with a barcode in the soundtrack, and then they spun the reels on an IBM computer for what was supposed to be fast, accurate data retrieval. In reality, the system didn't work, and Army clerks had to wander down the aisles of the warehouse and rummage through the paper mass in order to find some information. But most ambitiously of all, the U.S. Air Force applied innovative computer systems under what was called Operation Igloo White to build an electronic battlefield of sensors for bombardment of enemy logistics on the Ho Chi Minh Trail inside southern Laos. Now, you have to understand, if the U.S. was going to have any chance of winning the Vietnam War, we had, according to our strategy, it was a war of attrition. We had to destroy more manpower and materiel on the battlefield in South Vietnam than the enemy could infiltrate down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So the destruction of manpower and materiel on that Ho Chi Minh Trail was key to the U.S. victory in Vietnam. From 1967 to 1973, the U.S. Air Force spent $800 million a year to lace southern Laos with a network of 20,000 acoustic, seismic, thermal, and ammonia-sensitive sensors to locate those truck convoys coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It's less than 50 miles long. Through a hermetic data loop, the Air Force reported destruction of an incredible 25,000 North Vietnamese trucks from October 1970 to May 1971. The Air Force estimated that 80% of all trucks were destroyed. This was a claim belied by Hanoi's reports of losses of only 15% and the CIA's estimate that only 20% of trucks were destroyed. Now, why this gross miscalculation? Because what happened is that those 20,000 sensors transmitted signals. If there was a truck that vibrated the earth, a signal went out. The ammonia sensor. Why ammonia? Because mammal urine contains ammonia. That's why urine smells, and it could be detected. So if mammal urine were detected, a signal went out. If there was heat from a truck engine, a signal went out. 20,000 seismic indicators transmitting signals into the sky where a circulating EC-120 aircraft picked it all up and transmitted it to the biggest computer in Southeast Asia. And the IBM Corporation came up with something radical, a brand new innovation, a VDU, a visual display unit, that instead of getting all your information out of the computer by printout, you could see it on the screen. Those numbers would produce a graphic image. And in that U.S. Air Force installation, they had the VDU, and when that was a concentration of data, that produced the worm. And when the worm moved, that computer would launch F-4 fighter jets that would fly over the coordinates of the worm, and they would bomb the worm, and if it disappeared, then it was deemed that the truck had been destroyed. After 100,000 North Vietnamese troops passed right through that electronic grid undetected with tanks, trucks, and heavy artillery to launch the Nguyen Hoi Offensive in 1972, the U.S. Pacific Air Force pronounced the entire effort a complete failure. But there are also some successes obscured by decades of secrecy. During the war, the Air Force also accelerated the development of unmanned aircraft, adapting the Ryan Fire Bee drone for some 3,500 surveillance sorties over North Vietnam and Laos. By 1972, the SCTV model drone, with a camera in the nose, could fly for 2,400 miles, while airborne remote control officers could now navigate using low-resolution television images. This is the origin of the modern drone. Even though this computerized data gathering created illusions that contributed to America's soul-searing defeat in Vietnam, they served over the longer term as a productive experiment on the path to creating a third robotic information regime. And to that we now turn. Now, as the United States plunged into the pacification of two dense social formations in Afghanistan and Iraq under the rubric of the war on terror, Washington reacted to a failed counterinsurgency by developing new technologies of electronic surveillance, biometric identification, and aerial force projection, whose sum is now forming what may become a third distinctive U.S. information regime. After 6 years of a failing counterinsurgency effort in Iraq, the Pentagon applied biometrics to pacify Baghdad and electronic surveillance to produce instant field intelligence. After confining the populations of Fallujah and Baghdad behind blast wall cordons, the U.S. Army controlled these populations with an identification system that collected, as of 2008, over 1 million Iraqi fingerprints and, very importantly, iris scans that soldiers accessed by satellite link to a biometric database in West Virginia. Indicative of the difficulties of pacification in such alien terrain, Washington's war effort in Afghanistan has foundered amidst another dense social formation that defies its linear logic. In late 2009, for example, NBC News uncovered an elaborate PowerPoint slide that inserts the usual data flow of U.S. operations into a comprehensive schema of challenges which can be mastered. This is a map of what the U.S. intelligence and military thought they were facing in Afghanistan. Now, from small circular loops such as narcotics and criminal activity, through that ultimate existential self-referential circularity, coalition knowledge and understanding, the whole chart spins in a giant wheel of Ptolemaic proportions. Commenting on this chart, the former commander of Northern Iraq, the military intellectual General H.R. McMaster said, "It's dangerous because it can create the illusion of understanding and the illusion of control." Note that recurring word, illusion. Indeed, such illusory omniscience produced a searing defeat as the end of major combat in June 2013 prompted a sustained Taliban offensive, smashing Afghan police posts throughout the country and likely to end with these Islamic fundamentalists in a future coalition government. Yet this crucible of counterinsurgency in Afghanistan also served as a new frontier for testing and perfecting Washington's drone warfare. By early 2009, the U.S. Air Force had revived a technology abandoned since the Vietnam War and deployed a drone armada of over 200 Predators and Reapers that made, from 2009 to 2014, 413 missile strikes in Pakistan that killed as many as 3,900 people. Now, just as the Philippine insurrection of 1898 sparked America's first information regime and the Vietnam War its second, so the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan have served as the catalyst for fusing aerospace, cyberspace, and robotics into a third U.S. information regime. Significantly, both space and cyberspace are new unregulated domains of military conflict, beyond the rubric of international law that Washington can use more or less as it sees fit. Now, as Washington seeks to surveil the globe from the stratosphere and from space, the world might ask, okay, we know what terrestrial sovereignty is. It stops at the border. We know what the international exclusive economic zone for the sea. It goes 200 miles out in the ocean. But how high is sovereignty? how high above this earth is America, and what becomes international airspace? Well, after successive failures of the Paris Flight Conference of 1910, the Hague Rules of Aerial Warfare in 1923, and the Geneva Protocol of 1977 to establish the extent of sovereign airspace, some puckish Pentagon lawyer might reply, sovereign airspace is only as high as you can enforce it. Let's now examine each of these technologies whose sum is now forming the third robotic information regime. Let's start with aerospace. Although U.S. aerospace plans remain classified, we can infer from the specifications for its components that the Pentagon will, by about 2020, deploy a triple canopy shield reaching from stratosphere to exosphere, patrolled by drones, armed with agile missiles, linked by an upgraded satellite system, and monitored by a resilient space surveillance network. First, the lower stratosphere. In the lowest tier of the aerospace shield, within striking distance of the Earth, the Pentagon is building an armada of 99 Global Hawk drones equipped with high-resolution cameras to surveil all terrain within a 100-mile radius and electronic intercepts to suck up communications, efficient engines for continuous 24-hour flight, and eventually triple Terminator missiles to destroy targets below. By late 2011, the Air Force and CIA had ringed the entire Eurasian landmass with a network of 60 bases for Reaper drones armed with Hellfire missiles, allowing airstrikes against targets anywhere in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Next, the upper stratosphere. At the next tier above the Earth, the Defense Advanced Research Project Administration and the Air Force are collaborating in the development of the Falcon hypersonic cruise vehicle that, flying at 20 miles altitude, could deliver 12,000 pounds of payload at a distance of 9,000 nautical miles from the continental United States in less than 2 hours. That's the Falcon. Now, although the first test launches in August 2011 crashed mid-flight, they achieved 22 times the speed of sound and sent back unique data to resolve remaining problems. Since 2013, DARPA and the Air Force have shifted hypersonic testing from global strategic strike vehicles like the Falcon to tactical penetration of air defenses, with test launches for this new technology anticipated by 2019. Finally, at the outer reach in our triple canopy, the exosphere. The age of space warfare in the exosphere dawned in April 2010, with the Pentagon quietly launched the X-37B space drone, an unmanned craft just 29 feet long into an orbit 250 miles above the Earth. Look at it. It looks like a mini Challenger space shuttle. It's only 29 feet long. You know, everybody should have one. They're really cute, and they can fit in your driveway. You know, maybe you got a really big triple-car garage. You can fit in the garage. This is really nifty. And the best thing about them, no human support system. They're drones, unmanned. By the time the second X-37B prototype landed at Vandenberg Air Force Base in June 2012, after a very successful 15-month test flight, this classified mission represented a successful test of robotically controlled reusable spacecraft and thereby established the viability of unmanned space drones in the exosphere. And, as we should note, right here, that capacious cargo bay is big enough to carry an air-to-air or space-to-space missile to knock out enemy satellites. Also in the exosphere, where space drones and Terminator missiles roam, orbital satellites are thus the prime targets, a vulnerability that became painfully obvious in 2007 when China used a ground-to-air missile to shoot down one of its own satellites. Now, in response to China's success, DARPA, the Pentagon's chief research agency, experimented with the F-6 satellite. There it is, the F-6. That would decompose large monolithic spacecraft into a group of wirelessly linked components that would give the system resilience against an attack. Now, while China achieved a bold breakthrough in communication security by launching the world's first quantum satellite that transmits super secure photons, and they did so in August of just this year, the Pentagon abandoned the fractionated concept in 2013 and launch new conventional satellites that remain, in theory, quite vulnerable. Next, let's turn to cyberspace, another arena of global contestation. Instead of curtailing his predecessor's wartime surveillance, as was done after both World War I and Vietnam, President Obama has expanded the National Security Agency's digital panopticon as a permanent weapon for the exercise of U.S. global power. Now, in a parallel with U.S. colonial policing in the Philippines, such worldwide surveillance provides Washington with the information needed for its global hegemony. First, it provides operational intelligence on dissidents to be countered with covert operations or military intervention. Second, it provides basic political and economic intelligence to advantage American diplomats in bilateral or multilateral negotiations. Third, and very importantly, it turns up scurrilous information about derelictions of national leaders. It's always sex or money, one or the other, useful in encouraging their compliance. And finally, it provides the empowerment of what we may call a neo-imperial gaze, essential for the confidence to exercise global dominion. During the diplomatic wrangling over the UN, at the UN over the Iraq invasion back in 2002-2003, the NSA intercepted the communications and conversations of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, and they monitored the middle six of third world nations on the Security Council to discover which way they might vote, and then finding out what they could offer, a highway, a dam, or a favorable trade deal as a subtle form of bribery. Most recently, in 2013, the NSA helped President Obama at the UN by intercepting Secretary General's talking points in advance of their meeting. Now, while cutting conventional armaments in the 2012 defense budget, Obama is investing billions to build a new architecture for global information control. In the dozen years following the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. has spent $1.2 trillion to build a new architecture for global information control, including $500 billion on intelligence agencies and $791 billion on the Department of Homeland Security. By the end of Obama's first term in 2012, the NSA could, in collaboration with the venerable Five Eyes coalition of Australia, Britain, Canada, and New Zealand, sweep up 70 billion communications daily through an agile architecture of global surveillance that included access points for penetration of the World Wide Web of fiber optic cables, intercepts through special protocols and backdoor software flaws, the world's fastest supercomputers to crack the encryption of this digital torrent, a massive data farm in Bluffdale, Utah, built at a cost of $2 billion, and compliant federal courts that approved 100% of all NSA requests for mass surveillance. Since 2009, moreover, digital surveillance morphed into cyber warfare when Obama formed the U.S. Cyber Command, whose commander created a cyber combat center at Lackland Air Base in Texas, staffed by 7,000 Air Force employees. And very quickly, the United States declared cyberspace to be an operational domain for both offensive and defensive warfare, just like air, land, and sea. Beyond U.S. borders, the World Wide Web's centralization of most communications into a global network of fiber optic cables, routed through a relatively few data hubs, all accessible to the NSA, has allowed the U.S. a capacity, an extraordinary capacity, for global surveillance beyond anything the British Empire might have done with its transoceanic telegraph cables. Among Edward Snowden's many purloined documents, this is my absolute favorite. This shows the NSA, the National Security Agency's 2012 schematic for its worldwide signals intelligence cryptologic platform. And this indicates the agency had inserted monitoring malware on 50,000 computers worldwide through just 190 cable access points, which is an extraordinary economy of force for both worldwide surveillance and cyber warfare. With the rise of international electronic banking via the SWIFT network and the migration of commercial sex to the internet, where the five top sex sites in 2013 had 10.6 billion page views per month, the NSA thereby has ready access to the two timeless ingredients of political scandal, sex and money, money and sex. It never changes. Now, just as the Philippine Constabulary collected incriminating information about Filipino leaders like Manuel Quezon, So the NSA's director, General Keith Alexander, proposed discrediting Muslim radicals by exposing, quote, their vulnerabilities, such as viewing sexually explicit material online or using a portion of the donations they are receiving to defray personal expenses. In other words, sex and money, money and sex. At a 2012 Signals Intelligence Conference, Britain's counterpart agency, General Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, discussed its standard tactics for sexually compromising targets with honeypot entrapment. Now, as colonial police once surveilled thousands of local leaders like Agrippa and Quezon, who were the subordinate elites for control of the U.S. colonial empire, so the National Security Agency has monitored in recent years 35 world leaders, including three French presidents over a period of 6 years, 2006 to 2012, capturing highly sensitive conversations by François Hollande, and three German chancellors over a 15-year period, including Angela Merkel's confidential negotiations about Eurozone conflicts in 2011. Now, with a few hundred cable probes and computerized decryption, the NSA has now gone far, far beyond the domestic surveillance that the FBI once conducted under J. Edgar Hoover, or the Stasi's comprehensive coverage for all of East Germany. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, FBI agents tapped thousands of phones to compile compromising dossiers on hundreds of senators and congressmen. But even so, J. Edgar Hoover, after all that, still only knew the inner workings of just one city, Washington, D.C. To gain the same intimate information on an entire country, the Stasi had to employ one police informer for every six East Germans, an unsustainable allocation of human resources. By contrast, the marriage of the NSA's technology to the Internet's data hubs now allows the agency's 37,000 employees the same close coverage for the entire globe with just one operative for every 200,000 of the world's population, a model of modern efficiency. Ultimately, the impact of this third technological regime will be shaped by the integration of this aerospace array into the Pentagon's robotic command structure that will coordinate operations across all combat domains, space, cyberspace, sky, sea, and earth. To manage this flood of information within the triple canopy, the system will have to become self-maintaining through robotic manipulator technologies, such as DARPA's new FRIEND system that can deliver fuel, provide repairs, or reposition satellites automatically. Let's reflect on the meaning of this three-phase development of the U.S. information architecture. In sum, we now seem to be faced with two possible scenarios for the future of U.S. power, let's say at midpoint in the 21st century, sometime around, let's say, 2050. Now, as predicted in the U.S. National Intelligence Council's report, the relentless shift of world economic strength from west to east, from Europe to Asia, from America to China, might lead to a decline in U.S. global power. Alternatively, a technological Hail Mary's pass in the form of new robotic information regime just might allow Washington sufficient geopolitical power in excess of its waning economic strength to extend the American century to 2050 or maybe even beyond. But history offers some pessimistic precedents about the U.S. chances to preserve its global hegemony by military technology alone. The U.S. might have the same chance of controlling wider geopolitical forces with robotic technology that the Third Reich had of winning World War II with its so-called superweapons, such as the V-2 rocket or the ME-262, the world's first jet fighter. Complicating the future even further, Washington's illusion of information omniscience might incline the American military to misadventures akin to Vietnam or Iraq, creating new military miasmas with the potential for real disaster. Now, whether the future of U.S. global power is marked by expansion, stability, or decline, America's attempt to exercise worldwide dominion in excess of its waning economic power will be based over the next century on some version of its distinctive imperial information regime. Thank you.
That was Alfred McCoy, The Decline of U.S. Global Power. He spoke at the University of Montana in Missoula. Alfred McCoy is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin and author of many books, including Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We offer our weekly program free of charge to all public and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and beyond. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate-controlled media, such as Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, Naomi Klein, Richard Wolff, Chris Hedges, and Bill McKibben. We also have our classic 2-CD set of Alfred McCoy and others on CIA covert actions and drug trafficking. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Alfred McCoy on the Decline of U.S. Global Power, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Beth Ann Austin. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.